Welcome to another episode of the MCG Pediatric Podcast produced by the Department of Pediatrics at the Medical College of Georgia. I'm Jake Weiser, a medical student here at MCG. On today's podcast, we're going to be discussing an important general pediatric and pediatric orthopedic topic, developmental dysplasia of the hip. I'm joined by Dr. Erica DeMagg, who is a general pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Georgia. Welcome, Dr. Erica DeMagg.
Thank you for the introduction, Jake. I'm also delighted to have Dr. Melissa Allen, who specializes in pediatric orthopedic surgery. Welcome, Dr. Allen.
Thanks for the introduction. Developmental dysplasia of the hip, or DDH, is a super important topic to discuss because early identification and treatment can decrease morbidity and reduce the likelihood of surgical intervention down the road. Did you know that clinical hip instability occurs in 1% to 2% of full-term infants, and up to 15% have hip instability or hip immaturity detectable by imaging studies? This likely represents an underestimation since DDH covers a wide range of diseases related to abnormal development of the acetabulum and femoral head.
That's right, and it's typically the general pediatrician during the well baby check that may feel that classic click or clunk of the neonatal hip during physical examination. Failure to detect neonatal hip instability or to respond appropriately to an abnormal examination may result in a long-term disability for this child.
Exactly. General pediatricians are the first line to screen all babies for DDH. If left untreated, there are long-term effects that can significantly affect quality of life. Hip dysplasia is the most common cause of hip arthritis in women younger than 40 and accounts for 5 to 10% of all total hip replacements in the U.S.
Dr. Allen, you mentioned that developmental dysplasia of the hip covers a wide range of diseases. So how do we diagnose it?
That's a great question, since it is a slightly complex condition. DDH exists on a spectrum, which includes hip dislocation, its most severe, subluxation, which is a partial dislocation, or just a malformed shallow hip socket. In order for there to be normal development of the hip joint, the femoral head has to be seated deeply within the acetabulum. If the alignment is off at all, the result is DDH. I tell parents it's like jello mold gone bad. The acetabulum is the jello and the femoral head is the mold. The hip wanted to be normal, but the leg position was pushed in an abnormal direction, like in the breech position.
Okay, that's a good analogy.
Things that cause less space in the uterus, like being firstborn, a twin, or oligohydramnios, can also be responsible. Joint laxity plays an additional role, which is why it's much more common in females. But before we get into more details about DDH, Jake, why don't you present our clinical case?
Sure thing. All right, so we have Emma, who's a 13-month-old firstborn female who's establishing care in the clinic after moving to the area. Her mother, she has been growing well and meeting her expected developmental milestones, including walking, saying mama, dada, and dog, and is eating solid foods well with a pincer grasp. Emma was delivered 39 weeks by a cesarean section because she was in a breech position. Otherwise, she had no other medical or surgical issues. Her physical exam overall appears normal, but on exam of the lower extremities, you notice that Emma has decreased abduction in both hips and appears to have a waddling gait. There is no appreciable leg length discrepancy. Range of motion of the knees and ankles are normal, and she has normal muscle tone.
That's a great case, Jake. So we have a 13-month-old female that is demonstrating appropriate developmental milestones for language and fine motor skills. She's already walking, so it appears her gross motor skills are also progressing. But something just doesn't seem quite right on her lower extremity exam. Jake, what do you think is the significance of mom needing a C-section because Emma was breech?
Well, typically between week 32 and week 38, most babies in utero will settle head down or the vertex position. This is the normal and safest fetal position for birth. A baby that presents this late in a breech position, where the head is up and feet down, occurs approximately 1 in 25 term births. Babies in any breech position are usually delivered by a C-section.
Great job. More than half of babies in breech position have frank breech, which is when the fetal hips are in flexion and both knees are extended with the feet in close proximity to the head. Infants with frank breech presentation have the highest risk of DDH.
In addition to breech position, other risk factors for DDH include a first-degree relative with DDH, improper swaddling methods, and female gender. As I mentioned earlier, joint laxity plays a role in DDH, so that's why it occurs in females up to 4 times more often than males.
Since this is such an important diagnosis to not miss, how would I make sure that I can identify kids with DDH?
So the physical exam is an essential part of identifying these infants as early as possible to screen for DDH. It's important to check the newborn's hip range of motion. Jake, do you remember the names of the two maneuvers to check for hip dysplasia in the neonate?
That would be the Barlow and Ortolani maneuvers, right? Could you go over them? I sometimes get them confused.
Yeah, sure thing. So to perform the Barlow maneuver, the examiner adducts the hip, which would mean bringing the thigh towards the midline and then applying gentle pressure downward. A positive Barlow produces a clunk as the hip is dislocated posteriorly.
The Ortolani, on the other hand, is performed when the hips are flexed at 90 degrees and the thigh is abducted. The examiner then applies gentle upward pressure on the back of the hip. A positive test would be a clunk as the hip relocates into the socket.
I tell everyone who is first learning the names of these tests to pick one to remember and then the other is default. I recommend Ortolani because there is alliteration with the hip being out, and it's the one you really do not want to miss early on.
Okay, I see the difference.
It's also really important for the baby to be completely relaxed when you perform these maneuvers. If they are fighting the exam, you might get a false negative. Jake, do you know any other physical exams would be concerning for dysplasia of the hip in the infant?
I have heard about the Galeazzi test, where you flex the infant's knees when they are lying down so that the feet touch the surface and the ankles touch the buttocks, and then you look to see if there's a difference in knee levels, and I think that would indicate a potential hip malformation.
Yep, that's right. And for the Galeazzi test, we lay the infant supine on the exam table and flex the hip and knees 90 degrees. If there is a unilateral dislocated hip, then the knee on the side of the dislocated hip will be lower than the normal side. However, even with a normal Galeazzi test, an infant can still have an unstable hip, so we still want to perform the Barlow and Ortolani maneuvers to assess both hips.
It's important to keep in mind that these maneuvers are less reliable when babies are over 3 months old because the hip is starting to be in a more fixed position. Hip click can be normal, but hip clunk is never normal.
That seems important to keep in mind. So what's the difference between a click and a clunk?
So a click is a superficial and high-pitched sensation. You could also feel a click in a shoulder or knee. Clunks are a deeper, more prominent sensation.
Okay, that makes sense. So how long do we need to monitor an infant for DDH?
So the American Academy of Pediatrics, also known as the AAP, recommends that pediatricians evaluate infants for dysplastic hips on a routine basis. This starts from the newborn physical exam and continues until the child reaches walking age. As we mentioned, this includes looking for difference in leg length, asymmetry in the thigh creases or gluteal folds, performing the Barlow and Ortolani maneuvers, and looking for decreased abduction after 3 months of age.
Okay, got it. But so for Emma's case, she's already 13 months old and walking. How would we evaluate her for hip dysplasia now?
That's a great question. So once a child is walking, you should also be observing for any limp, waddling, or unilateral toe walking that could indicate DDH.
Oh yeah, that's right. Emma did have a waddling gait, but she's a new walker. So how do I know this is not just a toddler learning to walk?
So when we do our physical exam, we want to look for a decreased abduction in both hips. And then when she's standing and walking, you can also see some hyperlordosis, which could be another indicator of bilateral hip dislocation.
That's exactly right. And something very important to keep in mind is it's often missed. If hip dysplasia is unilateral, the Galeazzi sign may be present. But remember, if there's bilateral hip dysplasia, asymmetry at the level of the knees may not be evident. So you need to check for decreased abduction in both hips or any signs of restricted range of motion of the hips. This might be the only positive finding on physical exam.
So in Emma's case, we think she could have DDH based on her history and physical exam. What are the next steps if we see a kid in clinic and we're concerned about DDH?
So per the AAP, if a baby has a positive Ortolani test, then they should be referred to the pediatric orthopedic surgeon as soon as possible. If they have only a positive Barlow test, then they can be re-examined and monitored closely because some babies with a positive Barlow will end up having normal hip development. However, if the baby with the positive Barlow continues to have unstable hips, then that would warrant a referral to pediatric orthopedic surgeon by 4 weeks of age if the Barlow is still present.
Okay, and what about imaging? Would an ultrasound be helpful of the hip for diagnosis?
That's a great question. In addition to a referral, confirmatory imaging is helpful. If you have suspicion for DDH, the earliest we would want to do an ultrasound is 6 weeks of age, since you have a high false positive rate if you perform an ultrasound for an infant who is earlier than 6 weeks of age. However, if a hip is dislocated, then you should go ahead and ultrasound those infants' hips.
I would go ahead and order an ultrasound at 6 weeks on any baby that ever had a positive Barlow to ensure there's no residual acetabular dysplasia. You should also remember that technically, a positive Ortolani does not require any additional testing or imaging before referral to a specialist.
That's a great point, Dr. Allen. Choosing the type of imaging to perform also depends on the age of the patient. For children less than 3 months of age, we would do a dynamic hip ultrasound, but this is different for older infants. Did you know that the femoral head ossifies around 4 months of age? So for patients older than 3 months, we would order an anterior posterior pelvic x-ray and a frog leg pelvic x-ray to look at the hip for a better view.
So what if a child has a normal hip exam? Would there be any reason to get an ultrasound to screen for DDH?
So yes, so there are certain risk factors that would prompt us to order an ultrasound at 6 weeks. This includes risk factors we mentioned earlier, including babies who are in a breech position, as well as a positive family history and a first degree relative who has DDH.
A study done in the Journal of Children's Orthopedics that found the best strategy to avoid missed DDH in these high-risk patients is to get an ultrasound at 6 weeks. But even if that ultrasound is normal, these high-risk babies still need to be screened again with x-rays at 6 months of age.
Okay, I see. So it's really important to ask about positive family history and first-degree relatives with DDH.
That's right. There was another study in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery that supported this. They found that the benefits of screening breech babies or babies with a positive family history greatly outweigh the risks. The theory behind aggressive screening is that in high-risk patients, an ultrasound and x-ray pose little risk, but missing a diagnosis of DDH can create a lifetime of physical disability and medical bills. Other risk factors that make us consider an ultrasound include a history of previous clinical instability, parental concern, and history of improper swaddling.
So what exactly would be improper swaddling? I always thought that swaddling was helpful for fussy babies.
That's true. Swaddling is very helpful, and that's something that we learn early on as medical students and residents. What do you know about swaddling?
Well, I know it involves a thin blanket that's wrapped snugly around the baby to try to mimic the womb when done correctly. I think it can be an effective technique to help calm infants and promote sleep. Ideally, it should be discontinued as soon as the baby starts showing signs that they're trying to roll over.
Yep, that's correct. And as you said, swaddling can be problematic if done improperly. So if we consider when the baby is in the womb, their legs are in a fetal position and bent up across each other. Sudden straightening of the legs to a standing position can loosen the joints and damage the soft cartilage of the socket. So an improper swaddling position would keep the hips extended and adducted. In other words, straightening and tightly wrapping a baby's legs would increase the risk of hip dislocation or hip dysplasia.
That's right. Both the AAP and Pediatric Orthopedic Society of North America recommend that infant hips should have freedom of flexion and abduction during swaddling.
Okay, so Dr. Allen, what is the next step of management for children who have confirmed DDH?
After positive physical findings on exam or imaging confirming our diagnosis of DDH, we have a few options for treatment. Best case scenario is that we catch it within the first few weeks of life. If we catch it before 4 months of age, then we can start with a Pavlik harness. What do you know about the Pavlik harness, Jake?
Well, it's a harness that is designed to position your baby's hips so they are aligned in the joint and keep the hips joint secure, right?
That's right. It's back to the jello mold we talked about earlier. A Pavlik harness holds hips in a flexed and abducted position so the femoral head can be pushed into the acetabulum, allowing them to develop concentrically. Studies suggest that we can wait to use a Pavlik harness in non-dislocated hips until after 30 days of life, since before then, there's still a possibility that unstable hips can become stable.
Are there any risks to bracing?
There are some risks to note for bracing that we counsel our patients and families on. In addition to normal skin irritation, you can have avascular necrosis of the femoral head when the hip joint doesn't receive enough blood supply. This could also lead to degeneration in the hip. You should also be suspicious of a femoral nerve palsy if the infant stops demonstrating spontaneous knee extension while in the Pavlik harness. But typically, the femoral nerve palsy with Pavlik harness treatment is temporary and nerve function returns after the discontinuation or loosening of the Pavlik harness straps.
Unfortunately, for those patients who develop a femoral nerve palsy, there's a high failure rate with Pavlik harness treatment. This could be due to the fact that the complication occurs more frequently in severe cases of DDH as we put the hip into a hyperflexed position for stability or just the need to discontinue the harness due to the nerve palsy. However, treating DDH earlier with bracing carries a lower risk of complications than surgery. It's important to counsel these families regarding proper fitting of the harness and keeping up with routine follow-up with the pediatric orthopedist.
How long do these infants need to stay in the harness?
This is an area of controversy. It depends on the initial severity and how well the hip responds to treatment. Sometimes it's only a few weeks, but it could be months.
What type of follow-up do these children need once they have undergone successful treatment with the Pavlik harness?
For patients who underwent successful treatment with the Pavlik harness, it's important to perform radiographic monitoring for residual acetabular dysplasia. Patients need further radiographic monitoring throughout their growth until the measurements normalize. We expect early on there will be asymmetry in the appearance of the x-ray, but there should be steady improvement. Studies have demonstrated that for those patients with successful Pavlik harness treatment and normal radiographic acetabular development by age 2 years, all demonstrated continued normal acetabular development at a mean of 10 years follow-up. So these patients likely do not need further radiographic surveillance after a normal radiograph of age.
Okay, that's good to know. So what about older children, like our patient Emma, if it's confirmed that she has DDH?
If patients are older than 4 to 6 months of age or fail treatment with a harness, then the next step would be trying a rigid hip abduction brace. However, later presenting cases like Emma or recalcitrant cases require closed or open surgical reductions and spikocast immobilization.
Oh, wow. That seems pretty intense for these infants.
That's right. So again, it's important to identify these cases as early as possible.
And what would a surgical reduction involve?
The patient has a closed hip reduction. That means we just manipulate the hip into place under anesthesia and then hold it there with a spikocast. We use magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, to confirm the hip is well reduced in three dimensions. MRI is also great because it allows us to view the cartilage portion of the joint and the surrounding soft tissues.
Okay, and what about an open reduction?
So if the closed reduction fails, we move on to open reduction. This means that we make an incision and completely expose the hip joint to put it back into place. Unfortunately, this might also involve the need to make osteotomies or bone cuts in the femur and or pelvis to reshape them. Afterwards, we typically perform a CT scan to look at the reduction in three dimensions, since the soft tissue dissection and the metal implants interfere with the quality of the MRI. There are some recent advancements that the surgeon can consider that require an understanding of risk factors for developing complications, but that's a bit beyond the scope of today's episode.
So what would you choose to do for Emma?
Emma will definitely need surgery to fix her DDH since she presented to the surgeon at 13 months. Usually after the age of 1 year, we'll perform an open reduction of the hip because the soft tissues are blocking the reduction of the femoral head from sitting fully within the acetabulum.
Okay, and what about a patient even older than Emma?
If the patient is older than 18 months, we often also need to cut the bones to reshape the femur and acetabulum because there's just too much of a mismatch in shape for the joint to be stable. Reshaping the femur requires us to put in a plate and screws, which will also need to be removed after the bone is healed.
Okay, got it. So what type of surveillance and monitoring would Emma need after surgery?
Emma will be in a cast for 6 weeks to 3 months per hip and potentially a brace at night afterwards. We continue with regular monitoring of hip development in the coming years. There are some patients who require additional surgeries down the road for ongoing residual dysplasia. If the treatment is successful, though, and she doesn't have any complications, we do expect her to have a pain-free and functional hips for many years. However, she is still at higher risk for having hip arthritis than someone who never had any problems with her hips.
Okay, so that's definitely a big decision to make for parents and their infants. But what would the risks of not treating DDH or treating it later be?
Overall, like we discussed, the benefits of treatment of DDH outweigh the risk. If a patient had unilateral DDH and received no treatment, they would likely develop a limp, two different leg lengths, and limited range of motion in the hip. With bilateral DDH, you would likely not have a leg length discrepancy, but the gait would be affected. These children could continue to have a limp or waddling gait and reduced range of motion of the hip joint. In general, untreated DDH would cause further issues such as premature degenerative arthritis in the hip. Symptoms could develop as early as the teen or early adult years, and people with DDH would likely need a hip replacement earlier than those not affected with DDH. A hip replacement can also be more complicated in these later presenting patients, and they may need treatment at a specialty center.
However, by identifying DDH early on, we can hopefully prevent children from having surgery since the pavlic harness has a very high success rate. Children treated at a younger age also tend to have better outcomes since the hip has less time to continue down the path of abnormal development.
Okay, so we've spent a lot of time discussing evaluating, diagnosing, and treating children in younger age range for DDH, but what about older children, adolescent, that slip through the cracks? What can be done once they're identified?
That's a good question. Untreated DDH remains a major contributor to osteoarthritis in adults and potentially can lead to total hip arthroplasty with variable outcomes. The good news is there hasn't been recent momentum in the field of adolescent and young adult hip preservation surgery to help prevent degenerative osteoarthritis related to DDH. In adolescents and young adults, symptoms may be alleviated with a different type of bone cut known as a periacetabular osteotomy, but more time is needed to appreciate the long-term benefits of this procedure.
Okay, got it. Well, this has been a really informative discussion. I've definitely learned a lot today, and it's already time to start wrapping up our episode. So let's quickly review for listeners some take-home points for our discussion.
Sure, so I'll start us off. So for all babies, we want to note risk factors for DDH, including breech position, family history, incorrect swaddling, and firstborn female. On physical exam, you should conduct the Ortolani and Barlow maneuvers during well checks until 3 months of age. Afterwards, you want to assess for limb length discrepancy, asymmetrical gluteal folds, and decreased range of motion to clue you in on DDH. Assessment for DDH should continue through early walking age. Once kids are walking, a waddling gait and excessive lumbar lordosis are signs of bilateral dislocations.
For patients with risk factors, we have a very low threshold to screen patients with ultrasound. If you are ordering an x-ray, be sure you get a whole pelvis so you compare the sides. DDH can be really subtle and easily missed by those less familiar with the radiographic findings, but asymmetry can clue you in. Otherwise, the diagnosis is made initially on physical exam, as Dr. DeMag mentioned. If DDH is noted on a physical exam or imaging, we usually start with a palate harness for infants that are less than 4 months of age. For patients that are older than 4 months of age, we may start with a rigid abduction brace. Later presenting cases require closed or open surgical reductions and spicocast immobilization. Sometimes the hips still do not adequately remodel from the initial treatment, and we have to escalate up the ladder of options.
The surveillance starts with the general pediatrician and requires good follow-up throughout the infant and toddler stage. So when the pediatrician notes a positive Ortolani on exam, a persistent positive Barlow on exam, abnormal imaging, decreased range of motion, leg length discrepancy, or other physical findings, then they should refer.
Agree. It's always best to refer if there's any uncertainty, since the cost of misdiagnosis is high.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Allen and Dr. DeMag, for taking the time to talk about developmental dysplasia of the hip. I'll definitely remember all these things in my future practice as a pediatrician.
This was great.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
An additional thanks to Dr. Lisa Leggio and Dr. Rebecca Yang, who provided editing and peer review of today's discussion. Thank you for listening to this episode from the Department of Pediatrics at the Medical College of Georgia. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at mcgpediatricpodcast@augusta.edu. Remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as medical advice to diagnose or treat any particular patient. Clinical vignette cases are based on hypothetical patient scenarios. Free CME credit is also available for today's episode. Please refer to our show notes for the link, which also includes references for content of today's episode. We look forward to speaking to you on our next episode of the MCG Pediatric.